By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, I'll be talking to Fadi Masi of the banking team about regulation of cryptocurrency, or what's more broadly called digital asset regulation. Sanctions on Russia are in the headlines, and some in the financial markets have wondered whether cryptocurrency and other digital assets would allow sanctioned entities to go under the radar. The answer seems to be not necessarily so easily, and new rules are coming into effect that will make it even harder. Later in the episode, my co-host Sebastian Silva will talk to banking team analyst Felipe Carvalho about Chile's new, very young president, Gabriel Boric, who just took office in March and has reforms on his mind. Sebastian, thanks for joining the show.
Always good to be here, Danielle. Thank you for having me.
Sebastian, I've learned a few things about Chile's president, Boric, while I was researching this episode. One is that at 36, he seems to be the second youngest leader heading a government behind the 26-year-old Giacomo Simoncini, one of the captains regent of San Marino, the tiny independent state in Italy.
Interesting. I knew Boric was young, but I did not know that about San Marino.
Okay, and here's another interesting fact. He's a fan of heavy metal. He likes Deftones and Rammstein, among other bands. So let's just say his arrival marks a kind of cultural break with an older set of politicians, maybe.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, his youth is definitely a part of why we're talking about him today, I think. Not only does he have a background leading student political organizations, but he's managed to tap into the zeitgeist of the past couple of years, an eruption of discontent over inequality. So what started, for example, as a student-led protest in 2019 against the subway fare hike has spread now across the country and spanned generations and fueled a movement to rewrite the Constitution. So it's a remarkable escalation, really. And I'm sure you remember those protests. They were pretty big.
I do remember those.
So anyway, there's a lot in play, as you can see, especially in the financial system, which is what we'll focus on. First of all, there's been a demand for pension system reform for a while, which Boric has said his government would take on, but it's actually quite a complicated situation, as you'll see. Then there are the banks. The windfall of cash from withdrawals from the private pension system that have taken course over the past few years have helped them, really, but the dynamics are changing quickly.
Got it. Sebastian, that will be a really interesting discussion. But first, I'm joined by Fadi Masi of the banking team, here to talk about regulation of cryptocurrencies and other digital assets. Fadi, welcome.
Hi, Danielle.
So Fadi, you've just recently published a report on regulation of digital assets. First of all, by digital assets, you mean mainly cryptocurrency, correct?
Right. In this context, it's cryptocurrencies and stablecoins.
Now, here's an interesting thing. Regulation of cryptocurrency, to me at least, sounds almost contradictory. I always thought the whole point of cryptocurrency was to remain, you know, cryptic in the shadows. But then again, governments and law enforcement, I guess, probably want to keep some control.
Right. So although cryptocurrency protocols themselves are not necessarily regulated, many of the platforms that facilitate trading and custody of digital assets are indeed regulated. So it's more about how these cryptocurrencies are exchanged that dictates under which regulatory framework they would fall. Firms like Coinbase, for example, are subject to anti-money laundering and know your customer rules. So we can think about them as the regulated group of digital asset exchanges. And we think these regulations are credit positive. But speaking about the more regulated platforms such as Coinbase, their onboarding practices are designed to help detect bad actors. And the motivation of that is to protect the integrity of their venues and comply with the rules.
Okay. And I guess that kind of detection capability for an exchange like Coinbase is particularly relevant now, given all the sanctions that the US and Europe and allies have placed on Russian entities and individuals. How can crypto exchanges stop those individuals or entities from using crypto as a means to evade sanctions?
Yeah, it's a great question. And digital asset venues, I think of them as the bridge between crypto and fiat. So they go, you know, they offer services that go back and forth between cash and cryptocurrencies. They link a customer's bank account to their platform, and then from the platform, they can buy cryptocurrencies. So their ability to detect bad actors make them the gatekeeper of that bridge. So in early March, like you mentioned, there was a number of sanctions being imposed on individuals and territories in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Those sanctions, you know, there was a growing list, and that list was growing really fast. And the U.S. Financial Crime Enforcement Network, or FinCEN, issued an alert to financial institutions and to venues for digital assets to be vigilant against potential efforts to evade these sanctions. And crypto exchange platforms can deploy a number of techniques to flag and block sanctioned individuals or entities by blocking access to these sanctioned actors or even screening the list of their existing customers. They also conduct an interesting thing, which is they analyze what's happening on the blockchain to identify addresses that are potentially associated with sanctioned individuals. And what I mean by addresses, it's cryptocurrency wallet addresses.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the things that really intrigued me in your report, the extent to which blockchain transactions and data are really traceable. You gave a good example of how it works, talking about how the FBI was able to recover the ransom paid during the cyber attack on the Colonial Pipeline system in May 2021.
Yeah, so transactions that take place on a public open blockchain, they're traceable, and that's by design. So it's a feature, not a bug. In the case of the Colonial Pipeline attack, the FBI was able to trace movement of funds from digital wallet to digital wallet. And in the report that we published, we have a nice chart depicting the path that these Bitcoins took. So some crypto transactions can still remain outside the purview of regulated crypto platforms or be traded back and forth among bad actors on unregulated venues. But the good news is that in the case of the Colonial Pipeline, they reported the attack, and that allowed law enforcement to trace it. Actually, we have to assume that not all attacks will be reported, and that really could depend on the size of the ransom.
Now, you also talked in the report a lot about how the regulatory framework of crypto exchanges and platforms, or as you call them, digital asset venues, how these differ from the way traditional securities firms are regulated. Could you talk a little bit about that? What are the biggest differences in regulation?
Yeah, the main difference is that digital asset venues wear multiple hats. So they can be the exchange, they can be the broker, the custodian, and the asset manager. Whereas in the traditional finance space, these roles are traditionally completed by different parties, and that's by regulation, and mainly to avoid conflicts of interest. Another one is listing. We see a clear difference between what happens on digital venues or on regulated exchanges, for example. For these securities firms, such as the exchanges, there are well-established rules on how instruments can be listed, whereas for digital platforms, not so much.
So wait, you mean, say, a cryptocurrency exchange might not know what's considered a security when it offers a new product?
Right. We think they do a best estimate on whether a cryptocurrency will be treated as a security or not. Securities regulators so far have generally resorted to enforcement actions in lieu of regulatory clarity. But for example, in February 2022, the SEC said that it charged BlockFi Lending with failing to register its retail crypto lending product. In the settlement, BlockFi agreed to pay $50 million penalty to the SEC and another $50 million in fines to 32 U.S. states to settle similar charges. I mean, this points to a dilemma for upstart digital asset venues. You can either grow fast and attract customers by offering products that may require registration or lose out on market share, but comply with securities laws.
But there are signs that regulators want to bring some regulatory clarity to this digital asset space, right? The Biden administration just put out an executive order that seems to be a start in that direction, at least.
Exactly. I think the executive order was a great first start to guide where future regulation of digital asset will go. And the guidance there includes a number of priorities, such as consumer and investor protection, financial stability, and illicit finance. For cryptocurrency exchanges like Coinbase, having a regulatory framework would be positive because of the increased clarity and certainty of the rules of engagement for digital assets.
Fadi, thank you so much. And we're now joined by my co-host, Sebastian Silva, who will be talking to Felipe Carvalho about Chile's new president, Gabriel Boric, and what his policies and reform goals mean for banks and asset managers.
Thanks, Danielle. Felipe, welcome.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Sebastian.
Of course. So before we get to the effects of President Boric's policies, I was hoping maybe you could give a brief overview of what led the Chilean Congress to decide to allow some exceptional early withdrawals from the private pension savings plan, which has been a major focus. What was the problem the government was trying to solve?
Sure, Sebastian. The decision to allow individuals to dip into their savings through the withdrawal of mandatory pensions was to provide aid to individuals that were struggling during Chile's strict lockdowns. Chileans had grown tired of cumbersome aid packages that were designed to reach only the individuals that needed it the most, but people believed that it wasn't enough. I cannot deny the withdrawals from the pension savings plans were music to the ears of many extreme left politicians that still want the mandatory pension fund system that was established in 1982 during the Pinochet dictatorship to be discarded.
Right. That was the extreme left position, but the measures were approved by the right-wing coalition in Congress too, right?
That's true, Sebastian. These measures were approved with the help from congresspersons that supported the former center-right president, Sebastián Piñera, and against his administration's recommendations. Congress in all allowed three separate withdrawals of up to 10% of individual savings. This was a substantial amount. There were big incentives for the withdrawal. Even if you weren't having really financial troubles and probably knew that the pension fund administrator would do a much better job than you at managing your money, you still withdrew because some of these withdrawals were allowed to be done pre-tax. In all, Chileans withdrew more than $50 billion in retirement savings, which is equivalent to one-fifth of the country's GDP.
One-fifth is a huge portion, so the big impact here. How about the banks? What was the effect for the banks?
Well, these withdrawals put money in people's pockets, which pushed consumption, which resulted in inflation. A lot of people use their savings for consumption. Just in May of 2021, retail sales increased almost 40% month to month. However, not all pension withdrawals were used merely for short or medium-term consumption needs. According to estimates by the central bank, about a third of the withdrawals were effectively used for consumption. Another third ended up in people's checking accounts and savings accounts at banks. And another third was used to repay debt, mainly consumer debt.
Right. So it's like positive all around, really, for the people and the banks.
Yeah, I would say this had two positive effects for Chilean banks. We saw a wholesale decrease in non-performing loans, and the funding mix of banks benefited from an influx of cheap core deposit funding. To give you a sense, the non-performing loan ratio for consumer loans in Chile peaked in June 2020 at 5.5, and by December 2021, it had fallen to 2.9. A similar trajectory happened with mortgage loans. Non-performing loans there also fell to 0.4 in December, down from a peak of 1.2 also back in June 2020. At the same time, sight and savings deposits reached 36% of total funding as of year-end 2021, up from 25% as of year-end 2019.
I see. So the withdrawals were, we could say, generally a net positive for banks. The other major market participant here, of course, are the pension savings plan asset managers. What about them?
the sudden depletion of the funds managed by the pension fund managers, or AFPs as they're called in Chile, was difficult. But it also came at a especially complex time because already individuals were requesting that their pension savings be moved to the least risky assets, limiting returns and forcing these companies to recompose investments at an especially depressed time. The three consecutive withdrawals dispersed totaled more than $50 billion in savings, or around 30% of the system's total assets under management, which had been accumulated over 40 years.
Right, so $50 billion in savings over 40 years. That's a long time. So can the asset managers keep up with these withdrawals?
Continuing with these withdrawals would be difficult for them. These asset managers, though, have substantial market expertise, and the largest ones have geographic diversification. They have gone into Peru, into Colombia, or they're part of larger pension managers present even in Mexico. In an extreme scenario, these companies could become just traditional mutual funds that would manage people's retirements without the limitations that the mandatory pension fund system imposes on them.
Right. So let's shift over now to the new administration under President Boric. First of all, what is it that he said or has said he wants to do? Specifically, let's look at the withdrawals, for example. I believe he's been pretty clear that he does not favor any more early withdrawals from the private pension system plan. Is that right?
He supported the withdrawals as a congressman, but his stance right now has been very clear. He will not support any other withdrawals, even if there were to be another difficult scenario, because he doesn't think that it is fair that people be forced to use their own savings in such a scenario. Moreover, the economy is on a better footing than during the height of the pandemic, and inflation is already very high. And any other withdrawal would add fuel to the fire. Finally, the most vulnerable have already withdrawn all their pension funds.
So assuming there are no more early withdrawals from the pension plans, let's go back to the banks. What would the effect be for banks?
We expect deposit flows to return to more typical patterns. This will be gradual. As individuals seek to park their savings in higher return investments, such as time deposits or even mutual funds. On the asset side, we expect non-performing loans to normalize to levels that are more comparable to pre-pandemic levels, but also to pre-social unrest levels. And for example, for consumer financing, those levels were around 4.6%.
I see. So that shift, if you will, the normalization of certain fundamentals will likely affect the kind of lending banks focus on as well, right?
Yeah. Banks have begun to focus on lower risk portfolios and their origination criteria are still more conservative. So a normalization will take time. We expect banks to begin to take on more risk, but this will probably not happen before the finalization of the Constitution, which will end by September of this year. But also it's important to note that banks are well prepared for an increase in or a normalization in non-performing loans because they have accumulated extraordinary levels of reserves, equivalent to about 2.7 times non-performing loans. And they're likely to keep those until the political uncertainties related to the Constitution end.
And maybe even a bigger question, something a touch more radical or in the vein of an existential threat, the system itself. What if Boric has a plan, an idea to shift Chile away from the private pension plan and towards some kind of publicly administered pension plan?
That's a bigger institutional change, and it would require support from the public and from Congress. In a way, I wonder if various congresspersons voted to allow these withdrawals because it would cement among individuals that these monies that the government basically takes away from you every month are actually theirs, making it much more difficult for a future Chilean Congress to do what was done in Argentina a few years ago, when all mandatory pension funds were transferred to the ANSES, the National Social Security Administration. Moreover, even if Boric wanted to do so, his coalition doesn't have a majority in Congress.
Felipe, I've been wondering, you know, as you and Sebastian have been talking about all this, Mexico's pension system is sort of like the one in Chile, right? A private plan. Are there some of the same discontents in the population about how adequate or maybe inadequate pension income is when workers retire?
Yeah, absolutely, Danielle. But we also need to consider that the cumulative pensions in Mexico are much smaller as a percent of GDP than they are in Chile. So they really aren't in people's radars. As you know, Danielle, I'm based in Mexico. And in 2020, some changes were made that resulted in an increase in our contributions to the system. And there has been a continued push towards lower fees related to the management of these funds, which has resulted in much consolidation among the Afores, as they are known here, for example. In general, these are questions we expect to come up in various countries as life expectancies increase, population growth decreases, and as individuals begin to realize that their savings may not, in the end, be able to guarantee very high replacement rates, aiming the share of workers' salaries that gets replaced by pension income when they retire. So this topic will remain hot for some time.
It certainly seems that way. Felipe, Sebastian, and Fadi, thank you all very much for your insights, and thank you very much to our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like to read any of the reports referenced in this podcast, you can find those by clicking the link to this episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. And if you're listening to this show on a streaming service, please remember to follow or subscribe. And please tune in again on Wednesday, April 20, for the next episode of Focus on Finance.